Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Parents with children enrolled in so-called failing schools are caught in a limbo while lawmakers decide to expand or replace the performance-based EdChoice voucher program. The Ohio Senate last week rejected a House plan to replace EdChoice with a state-funded income-based plan. Instead, Senate leadership wants to fix the existing program and the report card system that led to a tripling of the number of school buildings affected over the last few years. State lawmakers must make a choice by April 1st when the state begins taking applications for EdChoice. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Thank goodness they can make some sense of this. Andy Chow is a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Jesse Bulmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Kathy Kandisky covers state government for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So what is, who among you, or is everybody covering this, and what's the Senate's problem? I mean, this is a big difference between the Senate and the House at this point.
I think what you see coming from the Senate side is this argument that the senators still want to portray themselves as being pro-school choice, and there have been certain legislators, Senator Matt Huffman is one of them, who have constantly been fighting for vouchers to be able to say that they have been the ones who have been expanding accessibility to the voucher system. And so what the Senate's kind of clinging on to right now is the idea of having a voucher program and granting vouchers based on the performance of a school building.
Because that means that economics would have nothing to do with it. Middle-class people who happen to have kids going to that school could still get the vouchers.
Yeah, you could have any type of income and still qualify for these vouchers if that school lands on the, and I'm quoting here, failing schools.
Right.
The problem is a lot of people argue, basically everybody is saying that the system to which we grade schools is broken and doesn't accurately portray schools in the right light when it comes to if they're failing or not. And so a school might be labeled as failing when it's not really a failing school.
Yeah. So essentially the main difference, and as Andy was saying, between the Senate plan and the House plan is whether we should have these performance-based vouchers and how many of them and to what extent and who should have access to them. I think everyone is saying there should be some sort of income-based voucher. And the House under Larry Householder is saying it should all be income-based. And there's a few exceptions for Cleveland and autism, but it should be largely income-based. And the Senate is saying we need to have some version of performance-based vouchers in place. And I spoke with Senator Matt Huffman about this, and some of the reasons he gave for having performance-based vouchers are there is some degree of accountability for the local school district, that if they don't want to be viewed as a, you know, quote-unquote failing school district, that they would make some sort of effort to get off this list. Now, the list has been criticized in general.
Validated? Has that been the case?
I think there are some schools that have made efforts to avoid this money going to private schools by improving their status. But again, a lot of criticism on how you get on this list. Another reason he said was, especially in like more urban affluent areas, maybe the cost of living is higher and thus, you know, your income is lower and it'd be harder to get on an income-based voucher system. And then the other thing he brings up is just we're not really sure how many people on the current performance-based voucher system could apply for an income-based voucher. We're not sure the difference between how many kids are getting it now versus how many kids would be getting it in the future. Now, I believe the House plan like kind of holds the people on the performance-based vouchers right now harmless, but going forward, you know, would we be cutting out a lot of kids who would have access to these private school scholarships, essentially.
It's also probably important to note the pushback they're getting from the public schools and the school superintendents.
Yeah, the superintendents have come out with a great hue and cry.
This is causing all kinds of budget problems because some of the money that goes for the vouchers comes from, you know, digs into the local district's funding. So that, you know, when they lose kids to vouchers, they lose funding and it makes it harder for them to deal with their budgets. And this would be, you know, if left untouched, this would be a huge expansion. So they, you can just imagine the problems the local schools are going to face.
And nobody's suggesting leaving it untouched. Even the Senate Republicans want to work on the existing EdChoice program and amend it. But still, they're still talking about a big expansion.
That's right.
Go ahead.
This past February 1st, that list, like I think you mentioned earlier, it was set to expand from about 500 schools to about 1,200 schools. And like you said, the Senate and the House were all working on trying to avoid that large expansion. So the question here is, do you still keep some sort of performance-based voucher program, or do you get rid of it altogether? The Senate's saying... The Senate's plan, I think, it still keeps the performance-based voucher, but whittles that school list to, I think, around 400.
420.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the House's plan would eliminate that program going forward.
And one important factor in this is the performance-based vouchers come out of the school district's coffers, and then the income-based vouchers come out of the state money.
And that's
of that's taxpayer money, but when it comes to the school district's budgets...
It holds them harmless. They're not...
The performance-based vouchers are more concerning to them.
Yeah. Right.
And like you said, the state's major school associations, so the groups that represent superintendents, school business officials, and school board members, they're all pushing for the House plan that moves this away from performance-based. And one of the arguments they made is if you take, you know, you can look at any sort of high school in Ohio that was not on the list, but then would end up being on the list, then all of the sudden, every student who lives in that high school's district who was already going to a private school based on their own choice, based on their own circumstances, instantly all that money would be drawn from that high school for kids who are already going to a private school. And that's one of the arguments that those school associations are making, is that, these families were already making the choice to go to a private school. And now all of a sudden, because that school is deemed failing, then money would be pulled from them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Kathy Kandisky, I mean, it's been since the early 90s when the voucher program started in
Cleveland. It was Governor George Voinovich was the one that started it, and it was just limited to the Cleveland School District. And that's, when did you say that was, the early 90s?
I think it was the early 90s, wasn't it? 91, 92?
Generally speaking,
by the late
a long
90s,
time
it was
ago.
In place.
Oh, okay. They were yammering about it.
And they've expanded it. There was an expansion to help kids with autism that I think the late Senator Peterson from Delaware championed.
John Peterson, right.
John Peterson, correct. So it's expanded a couple times, but the big expansion has come under the performance-based, and the questions about what the state report cards say about a district and whether you're performing well enough to stay off the list.
And it sounds like there's a fundamental disagreement about what the trigger should be when it comes to giving people choice. And there's a disagreement about what it means to be a failing school, too. I mean, this has been a really big problem, this expanding list of failing schools. These are in really high-performing districts now. It seems illogical to a lot of people from the outside.
Right. And so the people who are arguing to keep the program in place say that this is the system that has been around for years now, that there are parents who've been keeping a close eye on this list. And actually, we knew since November that the list was going to expand from 500 to 1,200. And so the pro school choice groups have been saying, if you change it now, then the families who have been making their plans since November, that's sort of just pulling the rug out from under them as far as the plans that they were making.
No one seems to like the school report cards. Are there any advocates for the school? I was sitting here trying to think.
Whoever's put them in there in the first place. I mean, are they gone now, or isn't there anybody still around who voted for it?
Yeah, there are people around who voted for it, and I think part of the issue is the state voted to change the report card to read as an A through F report card. So if you're meeting certain standards and indicators, then you get an A. And then if you're falling behind, then you get a C. But I think we're all programmed to see an A as a certain grade and then B as something else. And C must be kind of not great. Whereas a C is sort of middle of the road, getting close to doing well as far as a school building goes. So I think we're all just trained to see C's in a certain way, to see D's in a certain way. And that's part of the problem. Another problem is this K-3 literacy, for example. A district, let's just say a school has 100 kids and 90 kids pass the K-3 report card 1 year, and then the next year, 90 kids still pass that report card. Even though that's 90 out of 100, that certain school district didn't show any growth, so it doesn't get a its report card, its grade doesn't reflect anything other than not showing growth. And so they're sort of...
And that's what tends to trip up the higher performing schools. Yeah. The districts that you wouldn't expect to be on the list are on, that are on the list tend to be on it because they haven't shown enough growth or progress year to year. Mm-hmm.
Even though they are performing at a high level, if their exactly. growth isn't showing an increase, then they're hit for that.
What is your confidence level that the Ohio General Assembly can resolve this issue by April 1st, this next deadline they set for themselves? Jesse Balmer?
Well, I think we'll get close to that deadline again, just because history in this particular General Assembly has shown we like to get very close to deadlines on the past 2 years. I think it's something, the pressure will be schools are trying to make decisions about their budgets. Private school students are trying to make decisions about where they're going to attend. And so I think it'll be hard to push it past April 1st, but I don't think it'll be hard for them to take it right till April 1st. And I think that's because, as we've been discussing, they're still pretty far apart. Mm-hmm. You have on one side, let's eliminate performance vouchers entirely, and then the other side defending performance-based vouchers. That's not really close to a compromise right now.
Some kind of hybrid is going to come
yeah.
through.
Is that what you think,
yeah, I do. It's almost like the budget bill. It's something they have to get done. I think everybody recognizes they have to get something done. There's too many kids and students and families who are counting on it. But like everything else, they'll find some middle ground somehow, and it may look ugly.
Ugly,
right? And so
weird, messy.
In this current General Assembly session, we've seen the budget bill go past its deadline, the transportation budget go past its deadline, the big blockbuster energy bill known as HB6 go past a set deadline by a company. And so I think what we've seen, the trend has been over the past more than a year now, is that when you create these deadlines, it creates leverage for one chamber or the other, or from one lawmaker to another. And it kind of acts as a negotiating chip along the way, where why get a deal done now when you're so close to getting exactly what you want? Not 90% of what you want, but 100% of what you want. So you just kind of keep letting get closer and closer to that deadline to see if you can kind of squeeze more out of a deal.
Do you think, though, that it'll ultimately be a hybrid?
I don't know. I think
they're so far apart
you can
now.
Disagree
someone's
going to
have.
Well, I mean, it depends on.
No, I mean, someone's going to have to.
Yeah, it
give up.
I definitely think there
lot.
Will be a compromise, but I do think that one chamber might come out over the other as far as, you know, if a hybrid is 50-50, we might see something that's more 75% what one chamber wants and 25% of what the other chamber
do
wants.
Do we know anything about the governor's feelings on this score?
I think he wants this to be resolved more so than anything, but
so
where
do I.
He is, yeah, I know, right? Right.
I don't think he's.
I think he's been a little hands off in letting the two chambers kind of resolve it, which was how he addressed some of the things earlier. Obviously, he was very vocal on the gas tax, but I feel like maybe on the operating budget, he was less involved.
Yeah, I can't really. I'm trying to remember if he's been an outspoken proponent one way or the other when it comes to performance-based or income-based, but I don't think I've heard him.
I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
All right, we will continue our weekly reporter roundtable. You've got Kathy Kandisky, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jesse Balmer, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter, all joining us, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmert, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. There is a House bill been introduced that would punish physicians who help transgender children transition. This is a series of treatments. It varies. It's not a clear thing. And actually, we're going to be doing a show on it later this week so we can understand more what we're talking about here and what these folks want to control. But who's behind the bill and what would it do? Jesse Ballmer?
So the proposed bill, which we actually haven't seen the language of yet, but they had a press conference last week, and Representatives Ron Hood and Bill Dean are introducing this proposal that would create a third-degree felony for physicians who attempt therapeutic or surgical procedures to alter the gender of someone under the age of 18. And it's also being supported by a conservative group.
Even with support of their parents? Even with parental position?
Correct. And then that would be... that also has support from Citizens for Community Values, which is a conservative organization that has, you know, kind of Christian-based organization.
Uh-huh.
Which I think they've supported various pieces of legislation over the years. It's actually a bill that's been introduced in several states, including Kentucky. South Dakota legislature recently rejected it, saying, you know, that this is a decision that should be left to the families. And then the thing that I found interesting from my colleague Jackie Borchert's reporting is that it's pretty rare to do surgical options for those under 18.
Which is what they're bandying about as these you can't change your mind and go back.
An irreversible operation.
Thank you, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, one word will do.
Yeah. Well, and so I think it's really important to state again, like Jesse said, we haven't seen the actual language of the bill. And so I think what we're kind of assuming based on the press conference is that this would punish doctors who implement hormone treatment or hormonal therapies and surgical procedures. So, and what we've heard discussed a lot since this press conference is a common treatment known as puberty blockers, which is sort of for the small percentage of transgender kids under the age of 18. That's usually what you see first when it comes to medical treatment. And it would just, you know, it does what it says. It would be some sort of hormone treatment to delay puberty.
Yeah, it delays things like voice changes, breast development, secondary sex changes, and so forth by blocking either testosterone or estrogen. And Jackie spoke with the Cincinnati Children's Transgender Health Clinic, and they said that those are almost completely reversible.
Yes. And I think, you know, not to get into specifics of what was discussed during the press conference, but one of the main things out there one of the main messages that the group Citizens for Community Values was pushing and these legislators is what you're talking about, Anne, this idea of doing something at an age under 18 that could be irreversible. But in the hospitals that I talked to, they were saying that that's kind of And pro-LGBTQ groups have called it sort of like this boogeyman mentality of sort of floating out this myth that if a child says, I am transgender and I want some sort of gender affirmation treatment, the myth is that they go to a doctor and a doctor says, okay, and then goes into it. But there's a long thought out – what hospitals will argue that there's a long thought out process to all of this where therapy comes into play, where the parents are rolled into the system as well. So I think a lot of hospitals and doctors and medical professionals are saying that it's not just this quick snap of your fingers and then you instantly make this life-changing thing.
I think some of the supporters on this bill are also couching it as parental rights issue, that parents should be in charge of their child's, what health care their child receives or doesn't receive. And I think that's a big argument on the pro side of the bill.
But it would support, I mean, it would, even if with parental approval.
Mm-hmm.
It would.
Yeah.
But they cited, I think, I read Jackie's story as well, and I think they cited in it a case, a situation in Cincinnati where a child did get treatment against the parents' wishes.
Okay.
And then there was a parent, or a custody battle that ensued because of that too. And then another thing that was brought up when lawmakers were discussing the bill is this idea that, and you know, this is what they said, is that there's this idea out there that parents feel like they have no choice but to instantly sign off on what their child is saying because of public pressures, because of societal pressures to say yes
switch.
To this. Right. And that's, and so they're saying that they sort, the parents sort of might feel bullied into allowing this to happen when in reality they don't want it to happen. And again, that's,
is there evidence for that?
Not
okay.
Not that I know of.
And then I wondered about what kind of evidence we have about the demand for this kind of treatment. I mean, how many kids are we talking about? Is this a big deal? Jesse or Jackie, whatever you mean.
Representing my colleague, Jackie Porter.
Jesse, right.
You know, I'm trying to.
It's pretty rare. I mean, I don't think it's very common at all. I mean, but it's getting more prevalent, I suppose. You hear about it. You're hearing about it more with the emergence of a lot of talk about LGBTQ rights in general.
Mm-hmm.
You hear about it, but I don't think it's extremely prevalent.
I think there was one poll cited that said that just under 2% of America's high school teenagers identify as transgender, and so that's a very low population anyway.
And that doesn't mean that they want necessarily to transition.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think another thing that must be discussed when we're talking about this is the mental health of transgender teens and sort of the obstacles and challenges they go through when they're thinking through all of this, and if they have support from their parents and from their schools, or if they don't have support, and the sort of mental health anguish that can come from that.
Well,
too.
You know, children who identify anywhere on LGBTQ are already more likely, you know, to do harm to themselves,
mm-hmm.
Something like 30% more likely. And it's double that if they're transgender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think the same poll talked to adults, transgender people who are now adults, who discussed how their mental health improved when they did have some sort of gender affirmation in their earlier ages.
And I think that's one of the arguments of the opponents of this particular piece of legislation, is that transgender kid or teen could see the state legislature as, you know, coming after them or their family or their choices.
Judging.
And
judging.
We already have a piece of legislation that would, you know, prevent non-discrimination based on LGBTQ issues that hasn't been moving very quickly through the legislature, and has been blocked in previous years, or even just like including transgender on the list of discrimination issues in the House. So I think it just sends the message that the legislature isn't interested in transgender issues or their kind of choices and opportunities. Whether that's true or not, certainly that's the direction a lot of pieces of legislation are going.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Andy Chow.
Oh, and I think it should be, Jesse's exactly right. And on the other side of the spectrum, I think we should also say that what Jesse just mentioned, the Ohio Fairness Act, it's this bill that would include sexual orientation and gender identity, gender expression as protected classes, just like we have anti-discrimination code for race, sex, and gender. It would include those LGBTQ issues into protected classes. That's known as the Ohio Fairness Act. There's one in the Senate. There's one in the House. Both have received hearings. And I think it's important to mention that there are Republican legislators who have signed off as co-sponsors to that bill as well.
So it's a bipartisan supported bill.
It is. And so I think that also just kind of plays into that narrative that Jesse was saying, is that these House Republican and Senate Republican caucuses are a little split on this issue, where it's not just all one party or all one side going to one direction.
What about the speaker? What does he say about it?
You know, I don't know that the speaker's weighed in on this.
I don't think he's weighed on this particular issue. I know on the Fairness Act.
Yeah.
The Fairness Act, he has said that that's something they should look at or look into further, but really hasn't come out in support of it, as opposed to some of the Republican colleagues that have come out in support of it, and the Ohio Chamber of Commerce that is typically supportive of Republican issues has said that this is something that would be good for Ohio businesses.
The Fairness Act.
Yeah, right.
Well, the business community has been kind of ahead of the government on LGBTQ issues.
In general. Okay, well, we will keep our eye on that. Representative Jim Jordan got a lot of limelight during the House hearings on impeachment of the president. He also has been getting some press last week, most recently, but previous to that as well, when he was accused last week by a former OSU wrestler of trying to cover up his knowledge of sex abuse perpetrated by the team's former doctor, Richard Strauss. He was an assistant coach at the time. This already came up about, I think, almost a year ago is when it came up the first time. He seemed to escape very much scrutiny at the time. He insists he has no knowledge of the abuse at the time. But how is this changing anything? Or should it just be status quo for him going forward?
Well, Jim Jordan is interesting because he obviously has kind of the ear of the president. He's been a very prominent Republican in recent years and recently, you know, got in a key appointment to an important committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. So that's one reason why this is interesting. The committee that they were talking about this was actually in the Ohio State House.
Right.
So I don't think they have a whole lot of authority to force the issue. But what they are doing is forcing people to have a discussion about Jim Jordan and what he knew and what he didn't know at the time of Richard Strauss's, alleged misconduct. And they had a wrestler, Mike DiSabato, came forward and, you know, said he was victimized by Strauss. And people have said that Jordan knew about that at the time. Of course, Jordan has said that he didn't.
Right.
So it'll be interesting what happens from these hearings. But what it is doing is forcing people in Ohio to take another look at them. Mm-hmm.
And I think this was the move to restart hearings on this bill. It happened when House Speaker Larry Householder said that he was unhappy that OSU wasn't doing its own,
its
own moves behind the scenes to settle with these groups or to figure out a way to move forward.
So there's some sympathy there.
Yeah. And so what's happening is that Larry Householder said, well, you know, OSU's not making any moves, so we're going to jumpstart these hearings again, because this was the sixth hearing in this process for this bill. And so it'll be interesting to see every time there's a hearing on this bill, like Jesse just said, then more people come out and share more very heartfelt personal testimony of their experiences. And it does end up being a time for people to call out names like Jim Jordan. And I don't know if they want that to happen. So I think it might be playing into what Larry Householder was hoping would happen in the first place.
And playing into, you know, the bill itself would lift the statute of limitations to allow these victims the opportunity to file lawsuits against Ohio State.
Right.
So that's the big issue. Of course, Jordan gets all the attention because he's a big defender of President Trump. So there's a little politics involved in that. But the real issue here is whether or not these victims have the right to sue Ohio State.
And another issue that's come up from this, and especially Democratic Minority Leader Amelia Sykes has said, we should be lifting the statute of limitations on rape for all victims and not just those who were affected by Mr. Strauss.
Exactly. Also, there's another question about tort limits on on limits on what people can get in compensation.
Damages.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Now, there are three Democrats, from what I understand, vying to face off with Jordan on November 3 on Election Day. There'll be the people in his district will be voting on that on St. Patrick's Day, as I like to say, primary day
St.
in Ohio.
Day.
he's in a solid
red district,
you know, dark red district. Still three Democrats, and some of them have actually some, you know, spare change in their pockets. Is it hopeless because of gerrymandering?
I would say it's a very uphill battle for the Democrats in this case. I mean, Jordan's very popular, and mm-hmm. you know, his support of Trump has, I think, earned him more points in his
exactly.
very red district. Mm-hmm. Likewise, he has high negatives amongst Democrats. You know, I mean, you either love him or you hate him, basically. So I can see why Democrats would be drawn to challenge him, but the district is the district. It's pretty red.
Yeah. Dispatches, Rick Ruan wrote about this race, and they said that Jordan hasn't received less than 2/3 of the vote since 2012, and that was when there was a libertarian candidate in the race.
So someone kind of conservative-ish. Yeah.
Like, if that's any indication. Mm-hmm. I think these Democrats are going to be able to fundraise well because Jim Jordan has been in the news a lot, and mm-hmm. he's been
right.
you know, prominent in impeachment discussions and hearings and a prominent supporter of Trump. So I understand why they're raising the amount of money that they are, but this district is just very hard for a Democrat to win.
Yeah, I think if you sort of play a tale of two districts and you look at District 12, where Danny O'Connor sort of like cut down on the Republican stronghold and got sort of close to beating Troy Balderson, still lost by a few points. That's in a still a solidly red district, but not so supportive of President Donald Trump, whereas Jim Jordan is in a solidly red district in a region that
is very
heavily
solid Trump. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The 12th is suburban Columbus right. district as well, which I think makes a difference,
mm-hmm.
whereas Jordan's district is a rural, really red district.
Yeah. No funny business over there. No. We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Kathy Kandisky, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Governor Mike DeWine is pushing for a bill that would toughen penalties on distracted driving. He had a press conference about this last week. How would this bill change what the current law is?
So currently, like cell phone use is a secondary offense, which means you need to be pulled over for something else.
Like seatbelts used to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you went across the line or if you ran a red light or ran a stop sign or something, and then they saw that you were texting while driving, you could be penalized for that. The change would make it a primary offense. So if someone saw you using your phone, and I think that it would restrict things like even like entering the address into a GPS. You could use a GPS, but you can't be like typing on your phone to get onto it. There was a like one exception for like swiping if you were
on
like
Tinder.
I believe the intention was ride sharing, and
if you get a hit on Tinder, you're
however
allowed to
you
check
want
it
to
out.
Swipe.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
You digress.
I'm sorry. I'm just joking. That was terrible. Go on.
So, but would largely like dramatically reduce the amount of cell phone use you could be using in a car and make it more hands-free. And obviously that would reduce the instances of crashes or distracted driving and so forth is the goal of the legislation.
Driving safety in general has been a big issue for the DeWine administration. He's been focusing a lot on how to improve teenage driving to help them become better driving, basing that effort on the stats of traffic fatalities for teenagers. And so I think this is another crack at that. Not to say that teens are the only ones who text and drive, because I've seen plenty of adults who text and drive too.
That's for sure.
And I think the other thing here is, like Jesse said, there are laws in place when it comes to not texting and driving as a secondary offense. But with the evolution of mobile devices and smartphones, you know, you don't have to type in an address anymore. You could just click on whatever, you know, personal device you have and say, Siri, give me directions to this place. And so the need, you know, even that argument that you need to type in an address isn't really around anymore. So I think that's sort of taking a crack at that.
Unless you have an old car.
Unless Siri still doesn't recognize my voice.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Siri!
I think the argument would be pull over, type in the address, and then keep going for that. But
well, this is a thing for Governor Mike DeWine, and also it's called the Under the Hands-Free Ohio Bill.
Yeah.
He's saying the bill would save lives. Do we know anything about the fatality rates in states that have adopted similar measures?
I do not.
I don't know about I don't know about any sort of improvement in states, but I think what we have seen is a steady increase or, you know, steady level of numbers that show that in Ohio there are a lot of traffic fatalities that can or could be connected to distracted driving. And of course, distracted driving usually means being on your cell phone. It could also mean, you know, just being distracted
in
other ways. Eating, eating,
putting on makeup.
Yeah.
Reading a book.
Doing your hair.
Oh, I see people reading the newspaper, which I'm glad to see them reading the newspaper. But
I see people reading the
magazines
too.
Or turning around to yell at your kids in the back seat. I mean, there's all kinds of distractions.
Well, I'm lucky I survived that era of my life.
And I think when you talk to law enforcement and state highway patrol, I think they'll tell you, at least anecdotally, that it's become a major problem. Yeah. And when they see people weaving in the lanes and everything, it's not necessarily what used to be some sort of inebriation is now just being distracted in some way. And I think that's what they'd like to crack down on.
And it's gotten a lot more attention. And here locally in Central Ohio, of course, we would have to credit that to Dom Tiberi, who's been very vocal about his own daughter's death.
Sports reporter, yeah.
Right, Channel 10 sports reporter, about her death. His daughter died while being distracted on the road and ran into another car. So I think there's a lot more awareness about it, but I still think it's going to be hard. I mean, people have really grown accustomed to their phones. I mean, people are on their phones all the time. It's going to be a real behavioral change for people.
And I also think you've seen a few cities, including Columbus, adopt ordinances to make this a primary offense. And so there are some parts of the state where that you could be pulled over for it. But so this would move to make it a more
uniform,
statewide
once again,
issue.
Yeah. But so far they haven't tried to ban these ordinances in those.
Right. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if there's any opposition to this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll follow that one. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, a Republican, has been critical of a recent email fundraiser by the Ohio Republican Party. It accuses Democrats of trying to steal the 2020 election. These are fighting words nowadays in the post 2000 and post so many other issues that have popped up over the last 4 years. How did he respond to this rhetoric?
LaRose, how did LaRose respond to the rhetoric?
Yeah.
Well, his job as Secretary of State is to make sure people have confidence in the election system, and that's exactly what he did. He criticized his own party, the Republican Party in this case, although, both parties are probably guilty of making comments like this, and told him to tone down the rhetoric, basically. And I think that he got a lot of pushback from his own party, but I would give him credit for basically doing his job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the rhetoric that LaRose has been pushing since his time as Secretary of State, and it goes back to when John Husted was Secretary of State, is that election fraud is very unlikely, and has a very small footprint and a small impact on what happens in Ohio. He also one thing he's also constantly urging LaRose is that no voting machines are connected to the internet, which I think is one of those myths that kind of keeps cycling through social media. None of the voting machines are connected to the media, and there's a paper trail as well. So there's no way of digitally hacking into a voting machine, which I think is a common misconception.
Yeah, no one can steal the race.
And I think, you know, parties and candidates, the goal of these fundraising emails is to stir up emotions and get people excited or concerned or angry and thus give money over. But, you know, the Lourdes was saying, like, we need to discipline ourselves not to use language like that because it does give people the wrong idea. I think LaRose and Secretary of States or people who run elections across the country are really facing a lot of pressure to ensure confidence in the system, you know, given the interference from Russians that has been proven from previous elections to even, you know, the Iowa Democratic Party doing a rather poor job in the caucus. There is some concern that elections can be pulled off. Now, LaRosa said that was run by a party. The primary in Ohio will be run by the state. So that is kind of a different bag. But anytime there's concern about elections, it does create some anxiety that the results aren't going to be correct.
Speaking of anxiety, it's one of three new three conditions that the that Ohio is considering for medical marijuana use: anxiety, autism spectrum disorder, and cachexia, a wasting disease that causes severe weight loss. Is it the state medical board that's considering these again? Some of them again, right?
Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're going to ask physicians and experts on cannabis and so folks to review the petition, still look at various research and so forth. And then the new thing this year is the board is accepting public comment from individuals through March 1st, which they had not done before. So, you know, perhaps people with these conditions can make their case as to why this is something that should be allowable in the Ohio's medical marijuana program.
Yeah, my colleague Joe Ingles covers this process a lot, and what she was telling me is that every year, you know, people can come up with their submissions of what they think should be an allowable condition. So a lot of people probably remember that somebody filed that that you should be able to have medicinal marijuana if you are a fan of the Browns or the Bengals.
Yeah, right.
That was tossed out. But instead, but every year you do see some just kind of brought to the table every year. And this is another one where anxiety was once again being floated out there. And so now it moves on to the next step of the process, which is a further review.
And the vote, anyone can bring a petition for a condition. And the board just rejects it, can just reject it. And that's that. It doesn't matter. That's up to the board, like depression, insomnia, opioid use disorder. They've rejected all of those, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And so then they decide, so they can reject, they have the ability to reject it or choose for something to go into further review. So you're right. The three that they picked was anxiety, autism, and cachexia. And I think the thing about cachexia is that it was sort of new to some of the members or just a new thought to some of the members. So they really want to look into that a little bit more to find out what kind of impact medicinal marijuana could have on that.
Yeah, I think there is a frustration from those who submitted perhaps more, you know, backed up by research than the Bengals Brown thing, that there is such an authority from this group to just dismiss conditions. But there are a few more going forward.
So. That's the way they wrote the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all in the detail.
Jesse, you wrote last year that unions spent about the same amount on Ohio Republicans as they did on Ohio Democrats. It's a big change from 25, 30 years ago, obviously. How far out of step is that with union contributions nationwide, or is that something that's happening across the country?
So nationwide, it's more like 90% go to Democrats and 10% go to Republicans. And really, it's been the odd years, the kind of budget years, off years, where Republicans have been doing very well with unions. And there were a variety of reasons why 2019 really evened it up, one of which is, you know, obviously the Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, has been very pro-union, especially pro-trade union and pro-education union. You know, even going back to vouchers, he has the support from the teachers' unions on that proposal. It's in part because he has a lot of past history and experience with those groups. He has worked with trade unions before. His wife is a teacher, and so kind of understands that perspective. But there was also the House bill fight
House Bill 6 fight, which led a lot of unions to support the keeping open of these two nuclear plants in northern Ohio. And so there was some money spent there. And so it's just been interesting. Obviously, Democrats are still doing quite well with unions. But if some of that money is being sent to Republicans as well, how does that affect them? Because unions have been really a big lifeblood of Democratic campaigns for years.
Mm-hmm. And not just money, but organizationally mm-hmm. as well.
I mean, it's a practical approach. It's, Republicans have dominated the Ohio legislature and Ohio government for years. If the Democrats want to, if the labor unions want to participate, they're going to have to play ball. Otherwise, they'll continue to sit on the sidelines with it. And you're seeing, I can remember the building trades union in particular was really supportive of Governor Kasich. And when it came time, there was some debate about an unemployment compensation fix. And the building trades had held a lot of power in that decision. And I have to believe it was because of their support for Kasich.
Yeah,
and speaking of the unemployment compensation, nothing has happened.
Nothing's happened.
Yeah.
That fix
stopped the presses,
which is a win
happened.
For a lot of people.
Yeah, that quote unquote fix that they promised 2 years ago has still not.
10 years ago.
Yeah, ten years ago. Right.
Yeah.
Ooh. Guys, starting to smell like school funding. Okay, a dark money. Well, let's talk about the death. There's a conservative group mm-hmm. who call themselves Ohio Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. They're having a news conference tomorrow. What do we know about them and what are they up to? Jack?
Well, it's a part of a number of Republicans who have been coming out in support of either limiting or completely eliminating the death penalty. You've had people like the Speaker Larry Householder saying, this is getting too expensive. It is getting too cumbersome. We can't go back to some of these older methods of the death penalty and the current method of lethal injection. We haven't been able to get a hold of the drugs that are used in part because European companies don't want to send them to mm-hmm. us, but also in part we just keep changing kind of the formula of what we're doing to try to find a way to make it legal and constitutional. So what the current method has been is Governor DeWine has just kept pushing back the execution dates of individuals. And I think that's what you'll keep seeing because when we had our legislative panel, the Senate president, Larry Obhoff, said he didn't think his caucus was interested in eliminating the death penalty. And I think it would be hard to do with only one chamber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're definitely seeing the narrative change, though, where I think a lot of conservatives are ready to make that move to say, listen, we're against the death penalty now. And I think this has provided an opportunity with the fact that the state cannot at this point carry out an execution, I think just gives these conservatives an opportunity to say, listen, They might be against it for moral reasons, but I think they are also saying that they're against it for economic reasons, as it's just becoming too expensive to execute somebody, and to not be able to find the right drugs is also becoming a problem too.
I'd say the stars are kind of lining up because at the same time, public opinion is off on the death penalty, and juries are rarely sentencing death in capital cases these mm-hmm. days. So all these things put together are kind of the perfect storm for.
Yeah, there's a.
Except that even it's still this is a long term proposition, repealing something like the death penalty in Ohio. It's not going to happen this session.
I think it's unlikely. That's what the.
Because of the Obhoff opposition.
What they were saying.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find people in the House also have some concerns. The bill I keep going back to is there was a bipartisan bill that would have banned death penalty for those with severe mental illness.
Uh-huh.
And that couldn't get off.
Right.
Off and, never got a vote in committee and didn't make it to the floor. And so if you're not willing to eliminate the death penalty for those with severe mental illness, are you willing to eliminate it for everyone in Ohio?
Mm-hmm. But practically speaking, they can't get the drugs they need to do
right
to have lethal injection. So are they prepared to change the law to allow a firing squad or the electric chair or some other
alternative? Or less transparency in where they get the drugs from,
right?
Because that's part of the problem. We are out of time. Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us. I appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Time. Jesse Balmert, State government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for your time. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.